This is the Thursday Afternoon Show, and I'm Tom DiPietro, and I'm here today with the writer Paul Lafarge, who turns out does not live that far from us here in Hudson. He lives, is it okay if I tell people where you live?
Yeah.
Lives, sure. How long have you lived in Red Hook?
Don't give him my street address.
No. How long have you lived in Red Hook?
Since 2009.
2009.
Yeah.
Was that inspired by working at Bard, or are you just...
Oh, I had been teaching in the Bard MFA for a few summers, and my wife and I had been spending the summer up in the area.
Yeah.
And then the week before we got married, we were packing up our stuff, and the last errand we had to run was we needed to drop off our signed lease with the landlady, and then we were going to hit the road and come upstate and get married. And my wife, Sarah, went into the management office, and I waited, you know, with the car with all our stuff in it. She came back about 15 minutes later. She said, they're kicking us out of our apartment. The landlady was moving into the apartment. So we got the boot, and on the drive up, we thought, well, maybe this is a good time to move upstate. So we found a place, and we've been up here ever since.
Great. Pointed that out for our local listeners so that they know that local connection. But really, you're here to talk about your new book, The Night Ocean. You're the author of four previous books, right? Three novels and one unusual little book published by McSweeney's of dreams, short dreams, which at first, we won't go on a lot about that book, but it kind of speaks to what happens in this novel in the sense that you like to play with multiple identities, literary personalities, pretending to be people that they're not, and that kind of goes through a lot of your work, right?
Yeah, it's something that's that I've definitely worked with before, starting in the novel I wrote in 2001 about Haussmann, the urbanist in Paris in the 1850s and 60s, and that book had a kind of frame narrative about an obscure French poet named Paul Poiseuille and how he had supposedly written this book, which I supposedly translated into English, and then he became a character in his own right in my next book, which was called The Facts of Winter, and that's the collection of imaginary dreams which he wrote, and then I wrote a little afterward explaining how he'd come to write this book.
But they were, in fact, all written by you.
Well.
And, and of course, that kind of literary playfulness, I guess, descends from characters like Fernando Pessoa or Borges. I mean, it's in a sort of modernist tradition of playing with identities and multiple identities, even Flann O'Brien, for that matter, of somebody who would, you know, write books under different names. And this, of course, becomes not so much a kind of postmodern difficulty in the new book, but which is very readable, I should say. And, you know, I mean, it's not for listeners, it's not a dense literary book where you're always trying to figure out sort of the complexities of identity. But it's pretty clear how things shift, and there are a lot of major shifts. Let's begin with what really inspired the book, and that is the life of Lovecraft.
Sure.
H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah. So I was a fan of H.P. Lovecraft's work as a kid. I don't know if you are familiar with his writing.
I am. I never read him as a young person, but I read the Library of America edition, so I've caught up.
Yeah.
But I haven't read much of the scholarship, but I knew some of those names. And it was funny because you... Go ahead, and then we'll talk about that.
Sure. No, I'll just say, so he was a horror writer. He was active in the 1920s and 30s, and he published his stories in pulp magazines. And after his death, he attracted a cult following, and he's still in print, as you say. He's in the Library of America, and he's still finding new readers today. And The Night Ocean is about an episode in his life. So... I was out to dinner one night in 2005 with the poet Robert Kelly.
Who teaches at Bard, by the way.
Who teaches at Bard, and whose work I admired greatly. And we were talking about Lovecraft, and it turned out that Robert had also read Lovecraft and been a fan when he was a kid. And he had, in fact, known a guy who was friends with Lovecraft. And he told me a story about how in the summer of 1934, Lovecraft went down to Florida and spent about 8 weeks with a young fan named Robert Barlow. And this was surprising for a couple of reasons. One is that Lovecraft didn't get out that much. He lived in Providence. He did travel, but he rarely spent, you know, that amount of time with anyone. He was a kind of homebody. So that was unusual.
That's him speaking from the dead.
And here goes the train. The other thing that made that visit unusual was that Lovecraft was 43 in the summer of 1934, and Robert Barlow had just turned 16. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, why did this reclusive horror writer choose to spend 7 weeks in the middle of nowhere in Florida? I've been to Barlow's house, and it's about 15 miles outside the city of DeLand, which is itself, you know, pretty but not a great attraction. But really, right around there, you know, you're kind of off in the...
It was probably even more desolate at the time.
Yeah,
this happened.
You're off in the forest.
So the speculation is that there was some kind of homosexual attraction, or maybe not.
The question is why did this happen? And sure, it's easy to imagine that one of the answers to that question might be that there was attraction on one side or on both sides. And we know that Barlow would grow up to be a gay man.
Right.
That was a fact of his biography. Lovecraft's sexuality is a little more subdued. It's a little more obscure. It doesn't play a big part in his life. He was married at one point, and that lasted a couple of years. And after it ended, you know, he spent the rest of his life living with his aunt, and he didn't have romantic relationships.
Now, in many ways, this is, I hope you won't be offended by this, this is kind of a fanboy's novel in the sense that it's inspired a lot by the whole sort of culture of fandom, beginning with the fanzine, which, of course, is what Barlow himself edited at one point, right? Didn't he?
Barlow did publish a little fanzine, yeah.
About Lovecraft or about all?
No, he was publishing a general interest literary magazine called The Dragonfly, and it was there's a copy of it in the New York Public Library. It's beautiful letterpress thing with illustrations by Barlow, who was a child prodigy. He was an artist. He was a typesetter. He was a bookbinder. He played piano. He wrote. He made sculptures. And he was friends with Lovecraft.
So you take factual material and then just keep building and building and building as it goes out in all kinds of directions, it seems to me. Not just the life of Lovecraft, the life of Barlow, but then it becomes even more complex, not just in the present, but there's a kind of middle ground of the sci-fi writers of the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah.
And yet they're all really connected in fact, but then you kind of play with all that.
Well, historically, they're all connected through Lovecraft, who was enormously influential in creating what we think of as science fiction fandom. He wrote a truly staggering number of letters during his life. It's estimated that he wrote 100,000 letters, and he died at 46. So that's a lot of letters. He carried on all of these relationships with friends, with fans, with readers and editors and writers, and he put them in touch with each other so that there came to be circles of Lovecraft's friends who then went on to become writers and editors and to kind of shape the next generation of science fiction writing and also of fandom. So they're connected through him. Some of the people in the story are also connected through Barlow, whose life went in an interesting and strange direction after Lovecraft died, he moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, where he became an experimental poet. And then he moved to Mexico City, where he was one of the world's great authorities on the civilization of the Aztecs. And he also happened to teach the young William S. Burroughs at Mexico City College. His life is just this.
It's just that that's one of the incredible things about the novel is how I spent a lot of time, I have to admit, checking things on the internet, trying to figure out what's true and what's not. I mean, I recognize some of the names of the Lovecraft scholars, for example, Joshi and a couple of the other people mentioned. And then, for example, there's a Gilles Baron. I'm thinking, who's that? And then, of course, the only thing I could come up with, maybe it's kind of based on Michel Houellebecq or somebody like that. But, you know, there's this balance of real people and fictive people. And that's kind of one of the things you negotiate through the entire novel.
Yeah, there are a few fictive people here and there.
And, of course, the main narrative is fictive, the framing narrative.
Well, the present-day narrative involves fictive people. a lot of the historical stories, as you say, are I'm drawing on real historical people. And one reason why I wanted to do that is because the Lovecraft and his disciples turn out to have been fairly fascinating people. I spent a while trying to figure out how to write this book, starting in 2005 when Robert told me this story. And my first impulse was to make up characters who were like the historical people. But the more I learned about who the Lovecraftians had been, the more I thought, gosh, I should really just write about them as they were. There's no way that I could come up with something as rich or as strange as the actual lives that these people lived and the actual ways in which their paths crossed and recrossed and recrossed again.
Right. That's one of the amazing things, both in reality and in the novel, and why you kind of, and why I anyway was constantly checking to see things, you know. And on the one hand, certainly the whole history of science fiction is reflected in this narrative, you know, because you realize that one character who was a Lovecraftian and one of the so-called Futurians, which I'd never heard about and now know something about, then goes on to be a major publisher at Ace Books and then, of course, becomes DAW Books, Donald Wolheim.
Mm-hmm.
And he's essential to the history of modern science fiction.
Yeah,
somebody who published Philip K. Dick, for example, in the early years.
He published Burroughs' first novel also.
Oh, right, and the Ace, he published the Junkie novel. So these little connections are just like so stunning that they cried out to be somehow incorporated into some kind of narrative.
Yeah, the literary history is really it's interesting. It's kind of cool to see how it evolves from what was a circle of friends, and from a group of very strange people who were odd looking and had questionable personal hygiene and, behaved towards each other in odd and sometimes funny ways. The thing about them is that they're also quite interesting as people.
Right. And it intersects with sort of the old days of publishing and the rare book trade. I mean, I just got in at the sort of the end of the Fourth Avenue scene. I don't know if you're old enough to have actually been in any of those stores, but that was certainly the experience. I mean, when you talk about Samuel Loveman, who's real, and Samuel Roth, who was real, I mean, these are incredible characters to exploit in fiction. Now, as you said, the present day narrative seems to me more a cautionary tale about a number of things. First of all, it's about literary hoaxing, which has certain repercussions in our time. I mean, in terms of and it. Well, did you see it that way? I mean, did you see it as kind of like a commentary not necessarily a commentary, but a way of thinking about what it means to create alternate worlds, create alternate characters, and mixing them with real ones?
Yeah. No, from the beginning when I was thinking about this book, I thought that it would be a story about someone who perpetrates a hoax and gets caught.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to think about what kind of person does that, what kind of person is interested in perpetrating a fake story and writing a fake story and passing it off as the truth. And I also wanted to tell a story about you know, what happens to the community of writers and readers when that when a hoax is unmasked, right?
Right. You even make a reference to the James Frey
sure.
scandal.
Yeah, there were a few of those. You know, there was James Frey.
Oh, the T.J. Leroy. J.T. Leroy.
The J.T. Leroy story around 2005. Yeah. And they're fascinating stories. You know, they're people who wrote very interesting books, and then they became the object of public, not ridicule, but worse than ridicule.
Oh, yeah.
You know, real public animosity, and their books were swept aside.
Did you see the documentary about J.T. Leroy?
I did.
That was something, huh?
Yeah. I actually, I've been teaching a class on literary persona at Columbia, and we were lucky enough to get Laura Albert, who wrote as J.T. Leroy, on the phone, and she talked to us about writing that book.
Of course, that's how she justifies the whole experience, sort of, as that she always sensed that it was, I mean, there were, we sort of see her as just a hoaxer, but she also, she seemed to say in the movie that she was always assuming a persona.
Well, I think that the people who do that, you know, well, are, they're interesting people, right? They're kind of singular. So she was, she's a character. She's, mm-hmm. She was fascinating to talk to. And, I mean, I wrote The Night Ocean long before I had gotten to mm-hmm. talk to her and before this documentary came out, but I was trying to think about, you know, well, what kind of character does this? What's at the bottom of a person like that? And can you even get to the bottom of the motives of somebody who's interested in obscuring and concealing and deceiving?
And then it says something about those who want to believe it.
Yeah, it does. It says something about what happens, you know, when we want to believe, and then about how we turn on someone when our belief is shattered and we can't believe it anymore.
And the novel kind of goes back and forth, especially about Lovecraft, because we know that there are people who want to defend him to the end, that he, you know, that he wasn't any of these things implied by the, well, I won't explain exactly what happens, but, and then there are those who are just outraged that anybody, you know, who want to believe that he was, you know, capable of this relationship with Barlow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Lovecraft is a polarizing figure in real life. Mm. He was, rather infamously, a racist, a xenophobe, a bigot, an anti-Semite.
And that comes out in the book.
It comes out in the book, one of the few things in the book, which is really just a direct quotation from Lovecraft, are a couple of excerpts from letters that he wrote in which he expresses some of his views, which are full of venom. He hated everyone. I mean, he mm-hmm. really, he had a broad spectrum of hatred for people who were different than he was. And that...
And yet strangely married a Jewish woman for a short time. But that was a weird marriage, too.
He is a complicated person. He married a Ukrainian Jewish woman named Sonia Green. And many of his friends were gay Jewish men. You know, he had these convictions, which he expressed quite frankly in his letters and private writings. But in his life, you know, he behaved otherwise.
Which is why it's kind of funny that Roy Cohn shows up in the novel, because he had those same kind of bizarre ways of behaving.
Yeah, Cohn is also someone who was putting on his own little hoax about mm-hmm. himself. But, you know, Lovecraft, I think, attracts both champions, people who love his work and won't hear a word said against him, and who just won't really entertain the possibility that he seriously believed in, you know, white supremacy, et cetera. And there are people who want to see only the bad and say Lovecraft is a terrible human being, you know, and all we should say about him is that he was a bigot and a racist.
Right. Which is funny, because there was a piece in the latest New York Review of Books about Faulkner. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are some people who want to say, you know, Faulkner was just a mean old racist, and yet that's not all there is to say.
I think, you know, the catalog of writers who were also terrible people in one way or another is a pretty long catalog.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, so one of the things that happens in this book is trying to deal with that situation, thinking about how you separate the person from the work if you do, or how you read the work if you don't.
And the tentacles of this story kind of penetrate, and tentacles is a good, I guess, a good word. They're always talking about sea creatures and creepy creatures. Sort of penetrate a lot of areas of culture, including, say, well, there's a sort of extension into the Holocaust, which turns out to be a false lead, so to speak, sort of. And then there's the extension into the, especially with the sci-fi writers, into the anti-communist hunts of the 50s. No. Now, did a lot of those writers actually, I mean, I know some of them were definitely members of the party, but were they actually pursued by HUAC?
Yeah, not by HUAC, but Walheim was investigated by the FBI. I met his daughter, Betsy, and she told me some stories about how, you know, there would be an FBI agent just sitting in his office eating lunch with him and saying, "Don, when are you going to tell me, you know, when are you going to name names?" A lot of the science fiction writers who came up in the 30s were radical communists. Mm. You know, they believed pretty, they were members of the Young Communist League. They were pretty seriously invested in left-wing politics. And that became a problem for them in the late 40s and 50s. And some of them were investigated.
And I loved that in your acknowledgments, you make it clear how many of these people you actually, well, you were able to interview relatives, you were able to actually handle Barlow's zine.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, it's recent enough in history that you could feel it tactilely.
Yeah. Well, one of the great things about, you know, about works on paper is that they stay around.
Yeah.
So Barlow hand printed this thing in 1933 or 1934 or 1935, and it's in the New York Public Library, and you can take it out of its little plastic sleeve and touch it.
One of the standalone, I was kind of intrigued by this one standalone sentence near the end of the book where it says, "No reality but in books." And you know, it's a kind of intriguing notion because it does sort of provide not a coda but a little kind of something to keep in mind as you're reading this book, that it's a book kind of created from other books. A lot of it's based in your own research, I imagine, of reading other people. And it, you know, it's kind of also reminded me, I don't know if you've, I was reading Elena Ferrante's Frantumalia, and it was really, what really was powerful in that book is why she felt the need to create a persona who was writing these books. And that is, when people say, "Who is Elena Ferrante?" She says, "That is Elena Ferrante. Those books are Elena Ferrante. There is no real Elena Ferrante." It's that same kind of idea, that there is sort of no reality, in a sense, beyond the book that it's in.
Hmm. You know, the character who says that certainly believes it.
Uh-huh.
You know, the person who's talking, who says, "No reality but in books." And, you know, his reality is a world of books. The universe he lives in is a book universe.
I mean, we get the names of most of the books he read.
we get the names of many of the books he read. I think you always have to be careful, you know, when you assume that a character speaks for the author.
Oh, no, I wasn't assuming that. But I'm just saying that it was kind of, there was a certain, I don't know, kind of spoke to what's going on in the novel generally, that there are people who are for the most part living through books rather than actually living.
Well,
as the case is with him, the character we're talking about.
It's a novel about readers and writers, although Barlow really did find a way, you know, to live in the world. He was an anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
He traveled. He spoke a number of languages, some of them extremely difficult. And
I love that you included a picture of him.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a great photograph of him in his house in Mexico City. But he's somebody, you know, who really, his life was lived. It was short.
Yeah.
But it was vibrant.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess what I was trying to get at, though, there is this struggle between people who live through books and actual reality.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which keeps the book sort of grounded in a way that it's not just a literary hoax itself or a pretense. But I do think you put in a little bit of self-criticism. And that's when you talk about biographical vampirism. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure. This character is a kind of biographical vampire.
Did you feel that was like sort of speaking to the whole idea of using real people in a book, in a fictive book?
You know, I didn't think about that. For me, the question was never one of taking away someone else's life. It felt much more like a question of getting far enough into the grain of someone else's life that I could imagine it and bring it to life for the readers. Mm-hmm. It was much more a way of extending their lives, in this kind of imagined world.
So again, you think that was mainly just a comment about the character, L.C.
Spinks? I think that
he's the vampire.
Well, his motives are a little nefarious.
Yeah, to say the least.
To say the least.
Well, we've been talking to Paul LaFarge, the author of The Night Ocean, which is just published last month by Penguin Random House. What happened with For Our Strauss? No, you don't have to answer that.
Life goes on.
Yeah. And I noticed on your website there's other readings and events coming up. Yeah. Well, the one we haven't mentioned is right here in Hudson on Saturday. You're speaking in the volumes, reading in the volume series.
I'll be reading at the Spotty Dog with Melissa Phoebus, 7 o'clock in the volume reading series.
And it's an excellent series, by the way.
Great series. I've been to a few of their events, and it should be fun. And the Spotty Dog is a wonderful venue. They serve beer, and there will be music afterwards.
And I know the other day I saw plenty of copies there for sale.
Right.
So thank you, Paul LaFarge, for coming in and speaking with us here at WGXC. I hope everybody reads this novel. It's really a lot of fun, and it keeps surprising you. I think that's one of the main things that, you know, stimulates interest, is that it just makes these turns that are sort of based in all kinds of things. I mean, it just keeps going in different directions, but not in a way that sort of is mind-boggling, but very focused, ultimately. I don't know if that really is...
Thank you so much, Tom. I'm glad
you're welcome.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you're
enjoying. Bye.